Hey everybody, welcome to another From the Vault classic episode of the Brian Keane Podcast. This episode first aired on the 22nd of June 2020 and is with nutritionist Rosie Millen on burnout, adrenal fatigue and how to eat for wellness. This was an episode I recorded in 2020, as I said, that I was interested in talking about something that I've quite a lot of expertise in when it comes to working with people for their energy levels based on my background in nutrition. But the amount of messages and DMs and downloads this episode got in 2020 was incredible that I wanted to reshare it here for anybody that may have missed out on it or wants to give it a listen over from June 2020. And yeah, it's a good episode and very applicable for anyone that's struggling with burnout, adrenal fatigue, or whatever language you want to put on that syndrome, and how to eat for wellness in general. Also, if you enjoyed today's episode or any of the podcast episodes, please leave a rating and a review wherever you're listening to the episode. That would be incredible for me, for the show, and helps with the awareness for bringing on future guests that can hopefully help you with all the things that you are struggling with your health, wellness, or fitness. So without further ado, here's today's episode that first aired on the 22nd of June, 2020. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guest Rosie Millen, aka Miss Nutritionist on Instagram. Rosie is a fully qualified nutritional therapist after studying at the renowned Institute of Optimum Nutrition. She was diagnosed with severe burnout back in 2014 and made a lot of difficult changes in her life to bounce back and recover fully. Rosie was bedbound for 3 years straight and has since gone on to achieve an incredible journey that has seen her coach thousands of women to increase their energy and continues to go from strength to strength. She has helped multiple companies give their employees more energy and written hundreds of blog posts on how to recover from burnout, as well as writing her first book, Burnout is a Bitch, the antidote to the overworked world we live in. I'm really looking forward to diving into all things nutrition, burnout, and health in general for today's podcast. Rosie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
I mentioned a little bit about your backstory there, but can you dive into it a little bit more and tell us what led you on your current path to becoming a nutritionist?
Absolutely. So I guess if I take you back to March 6th, 2014, so 6 years ago, I was walking in the park on a beautiful sunny morning when all of a sudden I felt really, really dizzy. And before I knew it, my knees went from underneath me and I collapsed to the ground. And I freaked out because nothing like that had ever happened to me before. So I went home, I climbed into bed, and I basically stayed there for 3 years straight. And I couldn't move. At my worst, I couldn't even lift my head off the pillow. And I couldn't do small things. I found going to the loo very difficult. Showering was really hard. Obviously, I couldn't work. I couldn't socialize, couldn't exercise, couldn't see my friends. Like, my whole life just basically stopped. So I did what anybody would do in that situation, and I went to the doctors because I was just completely paralyzed with exhaustion. And I asked them to run some tests on me, and they said, yeah, sure, we can do that. But when the results came back, there was nothing wrong. My results were completely normal, and I was just, you know, told to go home and maybe take some antidepressants. So I burst into tears, went home, climbed into bed again, and I slept and I slept and I slept, and no amount of sleep would make me feel better. And I was absolutely determined to get to the bottom of what was going on with me. And I knew that all the doctors and nobody was going to help me. So I just had to figure it out for myself. So in that moment, I did a ton of reading, lots of research. I went to see lots of other health practitioners going. And eventually I got diagnosed with severe burnout. And you're probably wondering, what the hell was I doing before I collapsed? Well, I was working like a freight train. I thought I was superwoman. I just said yes to everything. I had no boundaries. I wasn't sleeping properly, wasn't eating properly, you know, over-exercising, all unintentionally. But you basically get burnout when your plate is already full, but you keep on adding to it. And so, you know, I was just going. And then one thing was the straw that broke the camel's back, and that was it. I collapsed. So my message is really simple. It's burnout sucks, and I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. And it really was the hardest thing I ever had to do, was recovering from burnout and get back on my feet. And it took me about 4 years to get to where I am today. Well, 4 years, where I was 6 years later, and I'm 100% recovered, but it really took me a good 4 years to get back on my feet. And it was really difficult. I had to make so many changes. I had to change my diet, my lifestyle, my mindset, which is why, you know, I feel really obligated to spread the message and, you know, talk to people like yourself and, you know, tell people how not to burn out. And that's why I get up on stage and I teach people how to be energized. And that's why I've written the book, Burnout's a Bitch, because I really just want to share with everybody how to get back on their feet and how not to burn out, because it's not fun.
That's a great visual, that a great description of a plate that is already full that you keep piling more on top of. And I'm going to double back into the Burnout's a Bitch in the book, but can you tell us a little bit about adrenal fatigue and burnout in general, just for those that are listening? And as you know yourself, as someone that's gone through it, a lot of people will be on some phase of the spectrum or some side of the spectrum on potential adrenal fatigue or burnout and not be aware of it. So can you tell us a little bit about it, what it is, and some of the kind of common symptoms that come along with it?
Definitely. I actually use the term burnout way more than adrenal fatigue, just to clear this up, because I know that the word or the diagnosis adrenal fatigue gets a little bit of sort of bad press. There's a stigma to it that people don't like, especially doctors. But I actually think that people can relate to burnout a lot more, and it just makes more sense. So I use the word burnout, but essentially what it is you have two little adrenal glands that sit on top of your kidneys, and they're your stress glands, and they're probably the most important gland in your body. And every 3 to 6 seconds, there's another gland in your brain that's detecting stress. Okay. So when it sees something stressful, like you have an argument with your partner, or you fall out with your boss, or you miss a plane or whatever, the hypothalamus tells the adrenal glands to pump two hormones into the bloodstream. And that is adrenaline and cortisol. Now, we've all been there. We've all experienced a stressful situation. And what our adrenal glands are doing is they're pumping out adrenaline so that our heart beats fast, our pupils stay late. But what cortisol's role is to make sure that we've got glucose running to the organs and into the muscles, to the muscles, so we can run away from that saber-tooth tiger or stand and fight it, right? Now, what happens is if you have, in today's world where we live in a completely overworked, overwhelmed, society, where we have one stress that doesn't go away, and then we have another one, and then it builds and it builds and it builds. And all these stresses that build up is called the allostatic load. And that basically means the amount of stress that we can handle until we basically collapse. So what happens is if you're experiencing a lot of stress, your adrenal glands can start to become fatigued and they start kind of waving their white flag. And so eventually what can happen is your adrenal glands stop producing cortisol, or the cells and the receptors become resistant to it. And that's when you start to feel really fatigued. And that is how too much stress can make you feel really burnt out and really tired. So it takes a while for you to experience a lot of stress and it to build up. Normally about 2 to 3 years for you to really feel completely exhausted. But when you've reached that stage of burnout, I mean, you really know about it. You're a shadow of your former self. And really the key signs to look out for are waking up in the morning and going to bed, and waking up in the morning and having a good night's sleep, but still feeling tired when you wake up. Okay. Losing your drive and your motivation is another sign to look out for. Finding small tasks challenging is another one. So, just brushing your teeth, having absolutely no energy to do anything, and feeling really fatigued after exercise. Quite typically when I see clients in my clinic and they've got burnout, they just feel really bad after exercise, and they feel even worse. So fatigue after exercise, dragging yourself through the day, having absolutely no energy, and having dizzy spells, unexplained dizzy spells. So these are really the key signs to look out for. But you've really got to take a detailed case history. What is it that you've been experiencing in the past 2 to 3 years? If you look back at your life 2 to 3 years ago, have there been any significant stresses? Have you had some real traumatic events that have maybe affected your adrenal glands? Have you been overworked? Do you have toxic relationships? Do you have a lot going on? Do you have lots more on your plate than you used to? Are you looking after your body? Are you sleeping well? Are you feeling all of these things? Are you relying on stimulants like caffeine and tea to keep you going? Do you have dizzy spells? What's your diet like? Are you nutrient deficient in certain things? So it's quite, I mean, sometimes I think it's quite complex, but actually it's quite straightforward, but I would say those are the key things to look out for. And that's kind of the best explanation I can give it.
I love that. There's so many questions there that it can potentially help people, because straight away you'll see a red flag jumping up as soon as you mentioned toxic relationships or overtraining or not sleeping enough or poor nutrition for people that are on the potential. And as someone that's experienced burnout several times as that type A personality that can has learned to cope with it over the years, one of the misconceptions I had was that stress is cumulative. It doesn't matter where it's coming from, and that it will compound on top of one another. So my philosophy for a long time was, oh, well, it doesn't matter if I'm stressed out at home. I'll just go to the gym and I'll train. But that's another stressor. Yes, it's a positive stressor, but it's cumulative in the sense of potentially putting you into burnout. Do you find that people have any other, or did you have any misconceptions when it comes to stress, such as that one, for example, where I separated them and categorized good stress versus bad stress, which can be helpful for some extent to do that, but not when you're on the path or on the road to potential burnout. Then it's just, you know, going to speed up. It's putting, you know, your foot pedal to the metal and on the car. But do you have any other misconceptions, or do you see any other regular misconceptions when it comes to stress?
Yeah, I think the first one is absolutely what you just pointed out, which is exercise. Most people, when they feel really tired, the first thing they do is they clean up their diet, which basically means that they eat less, and then they overexercise and they work out more. But when you're feeling burnt out and your adrenal glands are starting to feel kaput, that's actually the worst thing you can do. Because you have to remember that when you're fatigued, food in is energy in, and you have to bank as much energy as possible. And by not eating enough and going to the gym and doing really aggressive cardiovascular exercise, that actually tells the adrenal glands to release even more cortisol and adrenaline into the bloodstream, which is fundamentally what you want to avoid. So yeah, that's the misconception, is people think that they need to clean up the diet, which means eat less, and then work out more, which is kind of like backfires on your adrenal glands. And the second thing is the different types of stresses. So most people, when they sit in front of me, they're like, but I'm not stressed. And it doesn't matter, because everybody's stressor is different, but stress behaves exactly the same in the body. And most people don't know that an emotional stress, which people don't register quite a lot of the time, an emotional stress has 1,000 times more of an impact on your adrenal glands than any other kind of stress. So even if you're having an argument with somebody, or you're feeling emotionally drained, or there's a toxic relationship and it's emotionally draining you, that's having 1,000 times more of an impact and making you feel more tired than if you're just going to, you know, have a physical stress, like go out for a run or something like that. And these are the two misconceptions that I see across the board when it comes to burnout and people, you know, collapsing and being too stressed and starting to feel really fatigued.
What are some of the early warning signs, are there early warning signs, or does it vary from person to person? So if somebody is on that potential path or up in that journey where they're on the route or on the road to burnout, do you see common early warning signs, or is it just completely different based on the individual?
It's a good question. I would say there's a small cluster of common warning signs, which is that you used to have energy, like you used to be full of energy, but just, you know, all of a sudden, or just a little bit over maybe even a short period of time, you're just starting to feel really tired and you just don't have the energy to do anything anymore. That's really the first kind of warning sign, which is that you just were like, you know, kind of had so much energy, you have to go run it off. But now you just can't even do anything. Like you're just constantly lying down. You take naps during the day. You have no concentration. You know, you can't even read a text message because you're so fatigued. So you notice a massive drop in your energy, and just around the clock, you're dragging yourself through the day, and you don't understand why you're tired. And it's just all of a sudden, you know, you're just tired all the time, and, you feel like you're sleeping a lot and you're taking naps during the day, and it just doesn't make sense. Basically, you're a shadow of your former self. That's what I call it.
That's a great analogy. One of the warning signs that I have for myself personally is I don't feel recovered when I wake up in the morning. I'm like, it feels like every morning I've been hit by a bus. I'm like, right, I'm on that first step or the first rung of the ladder towards adrenal fatigue or towards burnout, whatever language. I know it's a kind of a word we can't really use, because adrenal fatigue, for those listening, is just, we'll stick with burnout just to avoid the controversy.
Waking up after still feeling tired, it's likely to be burnout.
Yeah, exactly. Do you find, and I'm going to dive in, go on.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because this is because when you're sleeping, that's when your adrenal glands are manufacturing the stress hormones, adrenaline and cortisol. So if you're burning the candles at both ends and not getting adequate sleep and skimping on sleep, which is the worst thing you can do, by the way, your adrenal glands are not going to be producing enough cortisol, waking cortisol for the next morning. And so your cortisol levels are going to be low in the morning and they should be high. So that's why.
That's really interesting, because obviously cortisol is a stress hormone that wakes you up in the morning, the melatonin to help you potentially fall asleep and the cortisol to wake you up. Do you, and I'm going to double back definitely on this sleep, but I want to dive into the nutrition side first, just to kind of layer this conversation a little bit. But do you find when it comes to the nutrition or the dietary side, that there are some basic principles that people can follow? And we can kind of go from two angles here, because the prevention angle is obviously different from the cure angle. But when it comes to nutrition, there's going to be 80% of people listening, probably 80 to 90%, who are in the prevention side. And then there's going to be that 10, 20% who need the cure. Is there a difference? Is the nutritional approach or dietary approach is the same for prevention versus cure? Or if there's differences between them, you can expand in whatever way you want. But what would be some of the basic principles that people should look into with their nutrition when it comes to either preventing or curing burnout?
Great question. And my answer is, it's pretty much the same wherever you are. I call it the burnout barometer. If you're like, you're okay, then you can still take these dietary measures to, you know, prevent it from happening. But if you're really, 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 really severely burnt out and you're in bed and you can't get out of bed in the morning, then dietary wise, it's pretty much the same. So the first thing is to make sure that you're eating enough food around the clock. So making sure that you're eating adequate calories. Because like I said, if you're skipping meals, or if you're doing fasting, and I get asked this question a lot, and I can share that with you in a minute. Then, you know, when you're skipping meals, your blood glucose drops, and then that actually tells the adrenal glands to release cortisol and adrenaline into the bloodstream. So it's mounting a mini stress response. So making sure that you're eating around the clock, balancing your blood sugar levels, not skipping meals, not fasting, and eating adequate calories is key for prevention and certainly recovery. So I like to advocate making sure that you're eating every 3 to 4 hours. And if you're really, really fatigued, and certainly people with, you know, even worse energy conditions like ME and chronic fatigue, they actually have to eat every 2 hours so that the blood glucose levels doesn't drop. So making sure you're eating around the clock, adequate calories, and every 3 to 4 hours so your blood glucose doesn't drop and you're not mounting a stress response. And making sure that you're having adequate protein at every meal and snack in order to balance your blood sugar levels. Most people are just fueling themselves on carbohydrates and caffeine, and then that's wreaking havoc with their blood sugar levels, and they're feeling even more fatigued and they're having energy slumps mid-afternoon. So for somebody with burnout or chronic fatigue or ME, that's definitely what they don't want that. They don't want to feel even more slumped. You combat that by balancing your blood sugar levels, and we do that by eating protein at every meal and snack. Now, you need about a gram. I don't know where your sort of opinion is on this, but across the board, you need, you know, just general nutrition, you need a gram of protein per kilo of body weight. So if you weigh 60 kilos, you need 60 grams of protein per day. If you weigh 80 kilos, you need 80 grams of protein per day, and so on and so on. But most people, like I said, are not eating protein, especially at breakfast. They're starting their day with, you know, a bowl of sugar, and then they're slumping mid-afternoon. So balancing your blood sugar levels is key, eating enough calories, protein at every meal and snack, and not having too much caffeine. There's lots of studies to show that caffeine consumption releases cortisol and adrenaline into the bloodstream, and thereby making you feel very stimulated. Caffeine can actually inhibit the release of melatonin at nighttime and keep you awake. So it really doesn't help your sleep-wake cycle. And caffeine actually has a half-life of 5 to 7 hours. So if you drink a cup of coffee in the morning, 5 to 7 hours later, half of that caffeine is still going to be in your system. And it takes a lot for your liver to detoxify it. So for anybody that gets that stimulated, shaky feeling when you drink caffeine, that actually means that your liver doesn't have enough enzymes to break down the caffeine in coffee. So again, if you're feeling burnt out and you're collapsing and you're knackered and you're exhausted and you're dragging yourself through the day, I would take caffeine out of the diet and do it slowly, just that you don't have so much of a big die-off. But every time I put anybody on a caffeine-free diet, their energy went literally, it significantly improved after about 5 to 7 days. Because caffeine is a stimulant, you know, it's a superficial energy, and, you know, you're not meant to be relying on it, especially if you're already you're not a strong constituency and you're feeling a bit tired and you're dragging yourself through the day. So I would say across the board, those are my nutritional tips. And most people are deficient in certain vitamins and minerals. So 50% of the population are actually deficient in magnesium. And magnesium is a mineral which is responsible for over 300 enzyme functions in the body. And what magnesium does is it relaxes the body, so, and relaxes the muscles, and it helps to dilate those blood vessels so that the blood flow can go through, and all the nutrients can go through and reach where they need to get to. So all of the organs that need that mineral. But stress actually depletes magnesium massively. And I find that people who are exhausted and have no magnesium, low levels of magnesium, they get very fatigued, aching muscles, you know, cramps in the legs, and just generally can't sleep. Same with, I find again, across the board, people with burnout and adrenal fatigue and chronic fatigue and all these energy issues have low sodium and potassium levels. And this is quite often why they feel dizzy all the time, because they don't have enough salt in their bloodstream. And so when they stand up quite quickly, they feel quite dizzy. And even if they're not just standing up quite quickly, you know, when you stand up too quickly from the chair, they will experience dizzy spells because they don't have enough sodium. So it's important to make sure that you're having salt first thing in the morning if you feel dizzy. And again, I find this across the board, that people with burnout and adrenal issues, they don't have enough salt. And when they put more salt in their diet or in their water and they drink it, it's really responsible for lifting you and making you feel less dizzy. So that's, I'm probably banging on too much and confuse everybody, but
not at all. No, there's so much value there, Rosie. Like there's, I'm going to pick out a couple of things, but just because there's a host of incredible information that you gave there. I want to focus in on the caffeine and the coffee in particular. Just caffeine obviously is one of the compounds within coffee, but do you have tips for people as a full-blown coffee addict who had to completely scale back? I've got it under control now, but it's always the gorilla in the room. I'm like, this could easily go back to 8 cups a day. What tips do you offer people who, because you mentioned not going off a cold turkey, which is something I tried to do and it was a terrible idea. What are your tips or suggestions for people who want to reduce their caffeine intake?
Definitely take it slowly. And it's really important to remember that when you take something out of the diet, you've got to replace it with something else. So it's like the swapping game. So swapping caffeine for the other alternatives. So things like, you know, you could, if you're taking a lot of caffeine in, like let's say you're drinking 10 cups of coffee per day, I would start by swapping some of those cups of coffee for decaffeinated coffee, and then implementing and swapping them with naturally caffeine-free teas. So that'd be things like peppermint tea, ginger tea, mint tea, lemon tea. And trying the caffeine-free alternatives. So I don't know if you've heard of something called Barley Cup Extra, Dandelion Coffee, Caro Extra. All of these things look like coffee, smell like coffee. They don't quite taste the same. But again, it's that swapping. It's that habitual swap. When you take something out of the diet, replace it with something else. So definitely do it slowly and try swapping it with those alternatives. That's definitely my first starting point in terms of tips there.
Yeah, that's very similar to what I did. The Dandy blend, the Barley Cup similar. It's very, very similar in terms of dandelion blend. But I added some MCT oil to it. I found that really, really helped because of the withdrawal of the stimulant, and then adding in some medium chain triglycerides. I just felt that my brain didn't feel as foggy for those first couple of weeks. So that is something that I found firsthand to be great if you're a coffee addict.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I was just going to say, don't drink coffee on its own. So have it with the coconut oil in there, or eat it, consume it with some food, particularly protein, because then it will buffer that blood glucose climb and it won't affect your blood glucose levels as much, because the protein is buffering that climb, if that makes sense. So don't just drink it on its own, have it with food.
Yeah, there's so many hacks that you can use for caffeine. Adding in theanine is another really good one for those of you who use caffeine before training. I'll always add theanine to it just to slow down its release. And I find that you don't get that massive surge in energy and that drop off. To pull it back to food, is there any foods that should be avoided when it comes to, and avoided isn't the right word, minimized is probably a better, as opposed to a dogmatic, don't eat any of this ever. In terms of minimizing a food, I've had plenty of people that I've had that conversation with too. I have plenty of friends who are like, don't ever eat this food. I'm like, okay. But is there foods we should minimize when it comes to preventing or managing burnout?
So the other two after caffeine are sugar and alcohol. So, and I'm talking refined sugary foods like, you know, biscuits, cakes, donuts, all the things that people love. And I know that the first thing you want to reach when you're stressed out is sugar, because it gives you that dopamine hit, which makes us feel calm and happy. And I'm not saying cut these foods out completely. I'm definitely not a food Nazi, but I do follow the 80-20 rule, which is 80% of the time, feed your body, give it what it needs, especially if you're burnt out and you're desperate to get your energy back. But 20% of the time, you know, have a piece of chocolate cake or whatever. But generally speaking, these refined carbohydrates and really high sugary foods, they wreak havoc with your blood sugar levels and give you that initial energy surge, but will make you feel tired in the long run. And they will make you have those energy slumps mid-afternoon, which again is something that you want to avoid if you're dragging yourself throughout the day. So just be careful. And you know, just doing sensible things, like, again, swapping those refined carbohydrates for the slow release carbohydrates. So, you know, I call them smart carbs. That's things like brown rice, lentils, you know, chickpeas, quinoa. These foods actually, they release their sugars into the bloodstream more slowly, and they provide you with fiber, magnesium, vitamins, minerals, all of the things that your body requires in order to produce energy. You know, our energy molecule is ATP, which is adenosine triphosphate. And we get that, a cofactor for that is B12, magnesium, vitamin C. And so, you know, if we're eating those refined carbohydrates, we're not getting those cofactors in. Whereas if we swap them for the complex carbs, like what I mentioned, you know, the lentils, the brown rice, what have you, you're more likely to provide your mitochondria with that cellular, with those building blocks that they need to have that energy that we can get. And alcohol, that's the other one. alcohol is, you know, it's inflammatory in the body, it's no nutrients, and it can actually block the absorption of vitamins and minerals, which we need for energy, like B12, zinc, you know, all these really micronutrients that we all really need.
I remember when I was researching my first book, when I was looking at alcohol and the displacing agent, how it works for literally pushing away certain vitamins. I'm like, oh, fuck. I'm like that, my Irish blood was like, oh, my God, is it really this bad that I'm not going to absorb vitamins? And it, yeah, and it is. Yeah, definitely. When you're in the place where it's cure versus prevention, it's like, yeah, it's again, it's very hard to make a positive argument for alcohol if you're bedridden and you're going to be there for 3 years if you keep drinking.
Yeah.
as somebody, Rosie, that puts out great content online, your Instagram page, the book now, obviously, but I'm curious, do you see any dietary red flags online? I'm not sure what your actual consumption behavior is like on Instagram, social media in general, but as a nutritionist and as somebody that puts out very valuable information around the topic, do you see any major dietary red flags that tend to trend online, or that are fads online, or that every time you see it pop up on your newsfeed or somewhere, you're like, oh my God, this just isn't true? Does anything jump to mind when I say that?
Yeah, I think that there are two things here. There's a different level of veganism, isn't there? So I know that a plant-based diet is brilliant, and I'm a big advocate for that. But I know that there are some vegans that get on the pedestal here across the board on social media, on Instagram, that are very strict on their on the way that they eat. And so I'm not into really strict fad diets. I'm very much into the 80-20 rule. So when I see vegans getting on their pedestal and telling everybody else that veganism is the best diet and it's for everybody, that's what I get a little bit irked on, because I know people that have had a vegan diet and they nearly died because it wasn't for them. And so, you know, dietary advice, it is specific, it is individual. So when I see things on Instagram where it's very strict, very left wing or right wing or whatever way you want to look at it, veganism, I think these people need to be a little bit careful. And I'm not saying veganism is a bad diet, not at all. There's massive benefits, but I just don't like it when people think that everybody should be vegan. I think that's dangerous. And I did see one girl a long time ago who was advocating, basically, she was like a fruitarian and she just basically ate fruit the whole time. And she was extremely thin and everybody was championing it. And I just didn't think that was right. So again, there's only a handful of things. Most people are getting it right. And I think people are very aware of red flags now. And that was a very long time ago that I saw that. I didn't say anything, but perhaps I should have. But then I was like, I didn't want to be that, you know, troll person. I don't like that. So it's just bullying online. So, but no, generally across the board, I think people they're much more smart. Everybody's much more knowledgeable now more than ever before. People are much more, you know, they educate themselves. They're much more interested in their own nutrition. And, you know, 10 years ago when I started, nobody knew what really a gluten-free diet was. Nobody even knew what gluten was. But now a lot of people are eating a gluten-free diet and they seem to thrive on that. So Yeah. What about you? Have you seen, what red flags do you see? Because you're obviously more in the fitness and the weight loss kind of area. What have you seen anything that you don't like?
Yeah, that's definitely one. Like the vegan, when it comes to vegan based diets, and I eat 80% of my diet, 90% of my diet is all plant based. I eat mostly vegetables, and not for ethical reasons, 100% for it fuels my body really well. Also, my body maintains muscle mass very easily. And I do ultra endurance events. So, you know, I run 100 mile ultras, etc. So having a lot of muscle mass actually doesn't support me on those runs. So a vegetable style diet helps me a lot with that. But what I find with people is the argument is where they've came from. And when I see the vegan argument online, and the reason I preface it with my nutritional eating is that people won't come at me with sticks and stones when I'm like, no, I'm telling you to eat your vegetables. Broccoli and spinach is good. But what I see sometimes with the, not all vegans, because I've had plenty of vegan people on the podcast who have been very good with their message, and they promote their message on find what works for you, etc. But some... if they've came, and the argument I always give is ask where that person or that vegan person is coming from. I'm like, if they've came from eating biscuits and cakes to switching to eating more plants and eating carrots and broccoli and spinach, I'm like, they're going to feel amazing. I'm like, of course they are. And then they're going to preach that on to you and preach that on to other people because it works very well for them. So I think navigating how people promote their message online is important, and their starting point is important, because it's very easy to be passionate and preachy about a nutritional plan and a diet and very tribal about your diet if it's worked for you. And I think being able to navigate that is important, but that's probably the biggest one that I see, or one of them. The keto diet is another one, but I'm not going to get into that now either, but definitely the vegan one, just to back up what you said.
Yeah, and there's levels, like I said, there's levels of veganism. It's if your tone is aggressive and you're kind of, you know, very narrow-minded and not taking on board, you know, what other people's case history and medical history is, and you think that a vegan diet's for everybody and you're very aggressive about it, that's something that I would be a bit concerned about, that's all.
Yeah, a very interesting one that I had on the podcast. It was actually over a year ago now. I had Michaela Peterson on the podcast, who is a carnivore advocate in terms of she eats nothing.
Wow.
But it's an interesting one, because she, and I got so much pushback on that podcast from people who hadn't listened to it, but she suffered her entire life through autoimmune issues. So she's been in pain for the majority of her life, has had replacements in her hips, in her ankles, and went on this carnivore diet, and all of it went away. All the inflammation, all her pain. And she was like, for the first time ever in my life, I have no pain. And I'm like, you can't argue with that. I'm like, 100%. I'm like, I'm not going to follow a carnivore diet. I'm like, but that 100% worked for you. And I think context is key, because not everyone's coming at or coming into a diet or an argument with the same background and the same backstory. And I think context matters.
Absolutely. Totally.
When it comes to sleep then, and to bring it back, because nutrition is obviously so important, but you mentioned sleep being equally, if not more important, when it comes to recovering from burnout. What are some of the issues that people have with their sleep? And I know this is kind of a deep rooted, because if you're in the midst of having burnout, your sleep is disrupted, etc. But what is your kind of approaches that you recommend to people in terms of, should they focus on a certain number of hours? Should they focus on any sort of supplementation around their sleep, any sort of routines? Or what's your kind of philosophy or approach when it comes to handling sleep in the prevention and actual cure? Because similar, I assume, would I be right in saying that they're similar in terms of nutrition, that the prevention and the cure would be along the same lines?
Yeah. And it's a great question. Most people, when you say what are their difficulties with sleep, is that they can't fall asleep. That they basically are lying there because their mind's going round and round and round and round, because they have such anxiety about the waking day and all their stresses. So what my job is to basically try to get them to calm down so that they can naturally fall into a deep sleep, which is obviously key. And so what can we do, and what nutritional support and supplements and natural medications can we do to do that? So the first thing is screen time. I don't know about you, if you see a lot of people that have bad sleep, but they are like, the hours of sleep you get between 10 o'clock and midnight are the most boosting. That's because when it gets dark between those hours, the pineal gland at the back of the brain is releasing a hormone called melatonin. And melatonin doesn't actually make us fall asleep. It's like the lieutenant telling our body to get ready to go to bed. And so if you're like awake within that window, and most people who are awake within that window, they're on their phones, and that blue light can actually inhibit the release of melatonin for up to 3 hours. So, you know, putting your phone away, putting your phone on airplane mode so that you are asleep within that window is really key. And that's really the game changer. Most people are on their phones, you know, looking at Instagram and, you know, scrolling at that time. And, you know, the average person actually, I think, what's it, they tap, swipe up or click on their phone 2,617 times per day. And, you know, 1 in 3 people check their phone in the middle of the night, and 80% of smartphone users are on their phone within 15 minutes of waking. So your phone is a real distractor when it comes to sleep. So putting your phone on airplane mode, putting it away, even in another room, across the board, I find that all of my clients find that exceptionally useful so that they can start to fall asleep within that window. So, you know, dimming down is really key. Starting to get ready for bed, sitting in darker rooms so you're not in a bright room is really key. Making sure that your room is cool, your body has to be 2 degrees lower in order for you to initiate sleep, and making sure that it's dark and, you know, you've got earplugs so you're not distracted, that kind of thing. Dimming down by, you know, having chamomile tea, lavender, pillows, hot baths, lighting a candle, doing some yoga, doing some meditation. And if that doesn't help to get your sleep-wake cycle back to a much more of a routine, because that's obviously what we want to do. It's really important to get that sleep-wake cycle in a healthy routine, so that you're falling asleep at the same time every night and waking up at the same time every night. Then you can take like natural sort of medicines and supplements. I like using something called the reishi mushroom, which is R-E-I-S-H-I, and you just drink it as a tea, and it's been clinically proven to reduce sleep latency, which basically means you fall asleep quickly and improve the overall quality of your sleep. I've just started taking CBD oil as well. And CBD oil, which is a non-THC version, you know, there's a massive growing body of evidence to support that it helps to calm you down and reduce the anxiety and kind of just dissipate the thoughts in your brain. And I know that a lot of people can't fall asleep because of this high levels of anxiety. So, you know, trying the reishi mushroom, taking some CBD oil, you know, doing some meditation, putting your phone on airplane mode, dimming down, all of these are my major sort of sleep tips. Have I missed anything?
there's so much there, and you're preaching to the converted. Like you mentioned magnesium earlier, which is one of my staple supplements before bed, just to wind down my central nervous system, and CBD oil is another one. CBD oil was that supplement that, and this happens very rarely because I've only got 3 staple supplements, a probiotic, magnesium, and now my CBD oil. But when I took the CBD oil, I was like, how did I live without this? It was one of those supplements, and that's rare.
What did you notice immediately? Was it just calmness or better sleep or just more energy, or what was it?
100% for me, it was all just to do with the sleep. So I follow very similar to the tips that you gave there. Like, I generally won't go on the phone an hour first thing in the morning and an hour before bed. And if I am, I have blue light blocking glasses. They're fantastic. The orange tint on them, they're really, really good. And I've got blackout blinds in my room. You know, so I go into a darker room about an hour before bed to try and get some of that natural melatonin production. Especially because Ireland and England is a little bit all over the place when the time shifts, because of the, you know, the natural circadian cycle. It could be bright until, you know, 12 o'clock, 1 a.m. So I know there can be a little bit of a disruption there, so I tend to use complete blackout blinds and blackout curtains. But the CBD oil, in terms of what I felt, it was 100% for sleep, because some people that have used CBD oil say that it works for anti-anxiety, etc. I didn't get that effect from it, but what I noticed was I was falling asleep easier and I was staying asleep. And yeah, it's just one of those supplements. As soon as I took it, it's very similar to you. I was looking at the body of evidence. I tried it and experimented with it a few times. It didn't work. And then I had a company, Hemp Heroes, who've been on this podcast, and they explained to me about the dosage, about getting the dosage right, the timing right. And then when I started taking it correctly, nothing happened for about 7 days. And then after about a week, it was as if someone flicked a switch and my sleep just got so much better. And it's become a staple since. I absolutely love it.
Love it. How much do you take? How many milligrams?
I take, I'm up to a kind of a full dropper now on the extra strength one, which is, I've forgotten the dosage on it. It's the extra.
500.
Yeah, it's the, no, it's a thousand. It's a thousand on my one. Yeah, but I'm 85 kilos, you know, heavier than a lot of people that would be listening to the podcast. So I had to experiment and I dosed upwards because I had only, it was significantly less than that when I started. And then I built upwards slightly and then I found that stable state where I just feel great on it. So again, because it's a new supplement, I'm always a little bit hesitant to recommend it per se, because it's not like creatine where, you know, it's been scientifically backed for countless studies, meta-analysis, meta-studies. You're like, well, yeah, look, if you don't have any underlying condition or kidney issues, you're going to be fine taking creatine and it will work. Whereas CBD oil is relatively new in this form that it's in. So I'm always a little bit hesitant to completely marry my current opinion to it just in case something changes. But from anecdotal experience, I'm a big fan.
Amazing. Me too.
One of the things I want to dive into as well, outside of sleep, is in your online course, you cover everything from, say, the role of supplements, a little bit of which we've talked on already, laboratory testing and how to balance hormones and intermittent fasting. We obviously won't go into everything in detail because that's obviously what you do in the course, but I want to jump into one or two, if you don't mind. Which of those four things, so supplements, laboratory testing, balancing hormones, intermittent fasting, do you think people have the biggest issue with or where they make the most mistakes in? Is there one that comes in quite frequently with you where people have a starting point misconception that they tend to come in with or that they tend to struggle with in the sense of making the same mistakes? Obviously, different people making the same mistake. Does anything jump to mind when you're working with people or when you're seeing people coming into your online course with that?
I think intermittent fasting is kind of going to be those ones where I'm on the fence with, purely because everybody thinks it's amazing and it is, it definitely works. But what people don't realize, it's not for everybody. So it's really effective if you're already very healthy and you have a strong constituency and you don't have any underlying conditions such as, you know, especially energy conditions like chronic fatigue, ME, fibromyalgia.
Can I just double back for a second? When you say intermittent fasting works, what's your, when you say it works, just for everybody listening, because people come at this, when, just to give context to people listening to this podcast, a lot of people have the misconception that intermittent fasting is for fat loss or for weight loss. When you say it works, are you talking from that standpoint? Are you talking a health standpoint, a digestion standpoint? Just to give context, to double back before we move forward.
Yeah. Well, predominantly it's used for weight loss, and that's what I'm talking about. It really works for weight loss, but it's purely because you're in a calorie deficit. But you know, it can contribute towards cellular repair. There's lots of studies to show that you live longer, but I use it as a tool and I don't use it on everybody. That's why, and you're talking about misconceptions here. It does work in terms of a weight loss tool. But I only use it for the people that don't have a history of eating disorders. They don't have burnout. They don't have energy issues because again, you're skipping meals and your calorie intake is lower. So that would be my only, to answer your question about misconceptions for those topics, that would probably be the number one there.
Yeah, intermittent fasting is a really interesting one. And again, I'm on the fence. Someone that practices it, just for context, I eat everything within a time-restricted window of 8 to 10 hours. It works really well for me, personally, for my digestion more than anything. But when it comes to, you know, studies for living longer, I'm always on the fence because most of those studies, if I'm not mistaken, are all in rat models. And then people will throw that, it's the best thing since sliced bread. You know, everyone should be fasting. But similar to the vegan diet, it's like, no, not everybody should do anything.
Yeah.
So I think that's important to understand.
Yeah, when it all came out, I think it was a couple of years ago now, when there was a big tabloid paper that said, live longer if intermittent fasting forever. And it was really blown up. So yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember one of my mentors said to me, and I'll never forget this line, because I threw that study at her and I was like, yeah, well, there's the study, and it's a pretty good study saying about the rats living longer. She was like, studying rats in a cage is like studying dolphins in the bathtub. And I was like, oh, that's a good point. I'm like, that's a fair point. It's not their natural environment. Yeah, I was like, I have no argument. I'm like, that's a fair, good point. I'm like, until there's human studies, she was like, save whatever you're going to throw at me. I'm like, okay, I'm good. So, yeah, I'm curious. In terms of balancing hormones then, that's something you address and touch on. What are some of the questions that come in? And what I love about your content, the way you put across messages, you come at everything obviously from an evidence-based approach, a scientific approach, but you have that wonderful balance where it's like, well, this is what the evidence says, this is what the science says, but you have to play around with it and see what works for you. And that's what I love about even today's interview, what you said. You've given so many multiple tools that can apply to people. When it comes to balancing hormones, what is the kind of questions that you're getting? And the only reason I bring that up is because in one of your recent Instagram posts, you were talking about your online course and balancing hormones, and that can mean different things to different people. What is a typical example of questions that come to you, particularly from your female audience, when it comes to balancing hormones?
It's just confusion. I get a lot of women who are confused. They don't know what's going on with them. They've got lots of conditions, symptoms. You know, they can't lose weight. They eat well. I think probably this is the most common one, which is they have a very strict diet. They work out like a racehorse, but they still can't lose any weight. And so me, I'm thinking underlying that's your thyroid hormone. So whenever I get any kind of hormone related question or confusion, I always say get it tested. So I'm a big fan in running laboratory tests. And there's lots of different tests that you can do to measure your hormones, but really the key ones are salivary hormones. And I use a laboratory test called Genova, and you can measure your cortisol levels, you can measure your DHEA levels, you can measure estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. And so really, if you are confused and you've tried everything and there's lots going on, you've tried lots of things and nothing is working, this is where tests becomes really, really effective and really powerful, because they're very black and white. And lots of people love that whole, oh, right, I get it now. It says on paper that I'm underactive thyroid. Great. Now I know what to do. And now I know what protocol to do, what I know what to eat, what to avoid, and which supplements to take, and so on and so on. So really, that's kind of my approach to how to balance your hormones. Is number one thing is just get it all tested.
Yeah, that's great advice. It gives you a black and white statement to work from, and then you can devise a plan around it. I couldn't agree more. That's something that I think more so now than even, as you mentioned earlier, 10 years ago, gluten-free diets, the resources for people to be able to test their levels now through Geneva, through, you know, Let's Get Checked in Ireland, or through your doctor or local GP, like it's a lot easier now to test for a lot of these things. And people like yourself, Rosie, who can interpret it, who can see it and go, right, this is what we need to do. We need to add in these foods because you're deficient here, or there's a hormone imbalance here, etc. So you've got direct feedback on what it is that you need to improve on. I just have one last question before, again, I've loved this conversation. You've given so much value. Like, I'm really going to enjoy re-listening back to this episode. I just have one last question, and this may be to do with the current book. It may be to do with something completely different. But what are you currently most excited about yourself personally?
My book. I wrote a book and it's amazing. I can't believe I wrote a book. you know what? I was meant to launch this book on June the 26th. But because of the virus, it got pushed to January. So that was it for me. That was quite sad and disappointing, but I'm still really excited about it because, like I said to you earlier, my story and my message is very simple. It's burnout sucks, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody. And so, you know, when I got approached by this publisher to write this book and spread this message, it really put a massive wind in my sails, and it really elated me. And I've poured my heart and soul into this book, and I'm so chuffed with it, and I absolutely love it, and I just can't wait to share it with everybody. So that's definitely the thing that I'm most excited about at the moment.
Oh, I love it. That is going to be such an awesome read. From all the value that you've shared today, I think if anybody's listening that is anywhere on that spectrum of burnout, that's going to be a must read, because Rosie, you have such a beautiful way of breaking down complicated ideas and but giving context to where different things apply. So I absolutely love that. So thank you so much. Can you tell everybody listening where is the best place for them to reach out to you, where you spend your most time online, and where they can connect with you directly?
Yeah, so I'm mostly on Instagram, and you can find me there, Miss Nutritionist. So I give away lots of, there's loads of competitions, lots of free advice, lots of online courses, all for free, loads of recipes. And obviously my book's in the link on my bio there, and it's available on Amazon at the moment. It's got £6 off, so you can check that out. And my website, I've just got a new website. It's www.missnutritionist.com.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, I will put that in the description for today's episode, wherever you listen to podcasts, and on the show notes on briankeenfitness.com. You can get everything that Rosie just mentioned. Rosie, thank you so much for your message, for what you put out there, for your time today. This was absolutely awesome.
Thanks so much.
There we go. I sure hope you had your pen and notepad ready, because there was just golden nuggets dropped left, right, and center in today's episode. One thing that Rosie mentioned at the end of the episode is laboratory testing. And just to remind people, I did a podcast a while back on, not that long ago actually, a bonus episode on how to naturally raise or naturally boost your testosterone and how to test for it. But in today's episode, we mentioned thyroid function. We mentioned lots of different hormones towards the end of the episode. And the company that I use and that I mentioned is Let's Get Checked. And I have an affiliate code with them for anybody that wants to use it, meaning that you'll get 30% off any test that you order from them, thyroid testing, hormonal balance testing for men or women. And if you use the code KEANE30, K-E-A-N-E 30, it will give you 30% off any order through that website or any first time order through that website. So that's who I use myself. That's who I use for my testing. If you've been following my Instagram stories, that's where I get my vitamin B12, my vitamin D tests, etc. So you can use that code if you want. And that's the end of today's episode. I'll catch you all next week.